Welcome to The World Unspun. I'm your host, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. While war and genocide means devastation for most, for the arms industry, it means big business.
The top 100 arms producers across the world have seen their profits reach 598 billion euros in 2023. That's an increase of 4.2% compared to 2022.
In April, we at New Internationalist launched our new series, How to Stop the Arms Trade, at a special live podcast recording and panel discussion at Palestine House in central London. From Palestine to Sudan, we discussed how our governments and institutions are fueling armed conflict and genocide around the world, what we can do about it, and how to build international links in the process. While the arms trade is vast and secretive, there's a groundswell of people across the world taking action to challenge its power, from the gates of arms factories to our highest courts.
Occupation!
Shut it down!
The border wall!
Shut it down!
Siege on Gaza!
Shut it down!
My colleague and co-editor, Amy Hall, spoke with Saeed Taji Farouki from Direct Action Group Palestine Action.
The political system and the legal system that allows this genocide to continue is deeply corrupt, and perhaps at its core has no interest in genuinely changing.
Maaz Saleh Idriss, a Sudanese peace builder and international programs manager at Peace Direct.
There is a lot of connections cross borders. Sudanese campaigners are connecting to Palestinians, to those in Congo, in Yemen, sharing strategies with the understanding that the companies, the governments who are profiting from this war are all connected.
Katie Fallon, advocacy manager at Campaign Against the Arms Trade.
While they laugh and try to undermine and say like all of these movements are pointless, actually when it comes down to it, it's a huge threat to the industry because it actually does work.
And Charlotte Andrews-Briscoe, a lawyer for Global Legal Action Network, which is taking on the UK government in the courts over its arms exports to Israel.
There are two main reasons why this case is really important. The first is that F-35s are killing Palestinians daily, and the British government is making us all complicit in genocide.
Stay tuned for the discussion. And please, if you like what you hear, follow us and give us a rating on your podcast app. It really helps other people to find us so that we can keep telling the stories that the mainstream media sidesteps. New subscribers to New Internationalist can also use the discount code THEWORLDUNSPUN for 20% off a print and or digital subscription to our magazine. You'll get access to our full digital archive, including our most recent issue on the arms trade. We'll also be releasing plenty more coverage on this topic over the next year, and you won't want to miss out. Now, on to the episode.
We're here to discuss UK complicity in the arms trade and what we can do about it. And thanks to demand linked to the genocide in Gaza and the invasion of Ukraine, revenues from the sales of arms and military services to the 100 largest arms companies grew to $632 billion in 2023. And that's profits basically made off the back of other people's misery. In recent years, there's been a groundswell of activism against the arms trade. And in response, governments and institutions who profit from the industry have been fighting back. Activists who've been taking a stand have been imprisoned, taken to court. Politicians have been attempting to rebrand arms companies as an ethical investment. And we've also seen our government ramping up military spending, while at the same time cutting the aid budget and slashing £5 billion from disability benefits. All in all, by the government's own estimations, its cuts to welfare are going to drive 250,000 people in the UK into poverty. And lining the pockets of arms company shareholders and increased militarisation is often done in the name of safety and security. But we want to question whose safety and security that is. It's certainly not the more than 62,000 people in Gaza that have been killed since the genocide began in October 2023. And it's a genocide that's utilised British-made arms and equipment. And here in the UK, slashing support for disabled people, privatising the National Health Service, failing to address the housing crisis doesn't really help our safety here either. And meanwhile, arms companies are being brought closer to political power and undermining our democracy at the same time. I would argue that the arms trade keeps itself safe and its backers. And it's also a global operation, so at New Internationalist, we're really interested in what's happening all across the world. And the 15 largest arms companies have a presence in at least 49 different countries around the world. Here in Britain, a heart of imperialism, we're strategically placed to take it on. And so this global industry needs a global movement to stand against it. And how we build solidarity across borders is one of the things that we're going to be exploring in our series. And also we're going to touch on it a little bit tonight. New figures out this week show that global military expenditure saw the steepest rise since the end of the Cold War in 2024. So the arms industry is definitely getting stronger. Katie, would you be able to explain a little bit more about how our government is an active participant in that?
Yeah, thanks very much, Amy, and hello to everybody. Thanks for being here and listening to us. It's always, I think, a privilege to speak about all of this stuff, but especially in this beautiful building as well. Yeah, there's so much I could say. I thought it would be worth just giving a little quick like global overview, just to put the UK's position into context. So from 2020 to 2024, SIPRI, if you might have heard, the Stockholm Institute for Peace Research, they put the UK as the seventh biggest arms exporter in the world. But the previous Conservative government would always have said that it was second based on the value of military contracts. So I think that's a good point just to highlight that there's a lot of contested information about arms exports, and it's an inherently opaque kind of system, whether you're looking domestically or globally. Something I'm always think is important to point out. So for that 2020 to 2024 period, the biggest exporters in the world were US, France, Russia, China, Germany, Italy, and then the UK. And the five kind of Security Council members are nearly always in that top seven. So the UK kind of is usually between fifth and seventh. So it just goes to show that our geopolitical system, arms exports, are actually right at the center of it, as opposed to something that's kind of happening on the periphery. Another thing which I think is relevant to everything we're going to be talking about is that the share that the US had over that period, that five-year period, was 43% of all arms exports in the whole world. And after them, which I think would have been, say, for instance, Russia, who's two countries down, is 7.8. And I think France was like 9 point something. So it just kind of gives an indication of how extreme the US's power is over everybody. I think these military exports speak to that. So kind of in line with that, like opaqueness. And I think another thing I've like said a few times since speaking is that even the most basic things about the UK arms export system, we can't say. So one of those would be how much and what exactly gets exported. The information that we do have, it's based on what the government publishes on the licensing system. But the licenses are, you know, they're issued to private military arms companies. That could be for services or for weapons or equipment or components. And they have to be signed off through like a number of different departments within government. So that will always be Business and Trade, FCDO, and usually MOD is involved, Ministry of Defence as well. But that is just, this is the permission of what the company is allowed to export. And then there's no requirement for them ever to say if this license was used. Some of these licenses will have like financial values and specify what the equipment is. And then the open licenses, so that those are the single licenses. And then open licenses will just have like, they're unlimited. It can be for any amount of value. It could have like a long list of different types of equipment and loads of different countries. And then there will be no information ever published about how much or what, if any of it, is ever exported. So I kind of started with some of the technical stuff, but of like the kind of the most severe with the most horrific violations of international law and genocide, those cases like in Yemen and in Gaza, the open licensing system is kind of a key part, because the F-35 license, that's an open license. It's not included in any time you might have heard like a government minister or an MP in parliament say, we don't export that much to Israel. They're always only quoting half because they're just saying the single licenses. They're not including anything from the open licenses. And so as it turns out, the very worst and like most lethal and also the most in like the highest in terms of monetary value, the F-35s, they just completely cut that out. And CATS, like where I work, Campaign Against Arms Trade, our estimation is that we've exported since that F-35 program started in 2016, 500 million worth of components for that program to Israel. And that is actually to Israel directly as opposed to the entire program. That's not like the UK share of the F-35 program, that's only just to Israel. So the rest of the program is worth even more. There's a few more bits I could say, but I don't want to go too much. I think, so briefly, the kind of the next most important thing, and I'm sure, Charlotte, you're definitely going to speak to this too, so I won't go into too much detail, would be the licensing system, like the process by which the licenses are issued. So I've already said it's like Business and Trade that lead that, and it's always the Business and Trade Secretary that signs off on those licenses. And it's just interesting to see who these ministers have been. Like when CAT was doing its cases on challenging arms sales to Saudi Arabia that would be used in Yemen, it was like Liz Truss, who was the business and trade secretary. And then you had Kemi Badenoch, who's now, you know, conservative party leader. So it's an illustrious and coveted position to be the one who gets to sign off on these licenses. And there, in terms of the kind of the legal bit, and I guess the bit that we tend to focus on is that criterion 2C of the strategic export licensing criteria. I think it's worth just like quoting it directly. It's obviously a bit like dry, but the specifics are kind of important. So along with, you know, many other criteria, it says, having assessed the recipient's attitude towards the relevant principles established by international human rights instruments, just to highlight there, like, so there is an obligation on the government to assess the countries that they are sending exports to, what they're, how likely they are to respect human rights principles. It says then the government will not grant a license if it determines that there's a clear risk that it might be used to commit or facilitate a serious violation of international humanitarian law. So like the key bits to highlight of that is that it's one potential serious violation. It's not widespread war crimes and genocide. It's not crimes against humanity. The way this was written was to prevent any of these crimes ever taking place. It was supposed to be preventative. It wasn't. And, you know, like Charlie, you'll probably be able to talk to more of this, but, you know, how that's been interpreted by government and by these departments, it couldn't. And there's a lot of onus as well. It's not, it's ministers and I think senior civil servant and foreign office lawyers colluding on just completely like twisting the meaning of that. Yeah. And I think I might leave it there, but yeah, just to highlight some of the other figures, you know, it's the UK government has exported 100 million since October 7th of exports directly to Israel. So this isn't like, this isn't stuff that's kind of ending up like the F-35 program at the moment where they're saying, okay, it's just indirect transfers. This is stuff that's been going directly, and they've always undervalued that figure. And then just, I think maybe we can talk more about this in the rest of the conversation, but everything that they say is like a twist on different narratives. And it just depends on how they can secure their own self-interest with this. So, you know, for Yemen, between I think it was 2013 to 2017, so that 5-year period, 49% of the entire UK arms exports for the whole everything was being sent to Saudi Arabia for use in Yemen. So there you can see the entire defense industry of the whole of the UK is relying on this particular conflict. Of course, like then you would hear things, okay, we can't stop exporting because we're so reliant on this. Then, you know, when it's Israel, they'll say this is a tiny percentage. So it makes absolutely no difference, you know, so it doesn't matter. And the point of, you know, as you can, I mean, that bit of legislation that I read is just a legalistic way of saying like, we shouldn't be, you know, giving weapons when we know for a fact they're going to be used in war crimes. But it's just a constant like changing of the narrative to suit keeping the status quo exactly as it is.
Thank you. So yeah, Charlotte, you're part of a legal team which has been fighting the UK government in court over its arms exports to Israel. Would you be able to briefly explain like what the case is about for people that might not know, and also what makes it so important in terms of the wider struggle against the arms trade?
Thank you. It's such a privilege to be speaking in Palestine House. This is an amazing initiative, and it's also physically beautiful. It's my first time here. I have the privilege of representing Al-Haq. Al-Haq is the oldest human rights organization in Palestine, established in 1979, in its challenge against the Secretary of State for Business and Trade for his continued decision to grant export licenses for arms sales to Israel. Cicelo Nguenya is also part of the legal team in the audience there. So I'll just tell you like a tiny bit about the procedural history of the case and then basically where we are now. On October 16th, 2023, we sent our first letter under the pre-action protocol, establishing why arms sales to Israel at that point were unlawful. As Katie mentioned, criterion 2C of the strategic export licensing criteria should be a very low threshold. It talks about there being a clear risk that the item might be used to commit or facilitate a serious violation of international humanitarian law. We brought in the Arms Trade Treaty. The UK is also a signatory to the Genocide Convention, so we also brought in the Genocide Convention and the serious risks of genocide at that time. On December 6th, after essentially 3 months of the government ignoring us, on December 6th, we issued proceedings against the government, and we outlined the manifold ways in which Israel had already violated international humanitarian law. For example, attacks directed at civilian objects, hospitals, schools, refugee camps, the deliberate targeting of safe zones, unlawful mass evacuation orders, and the serious risk of genocide. Between December 2023 and April 2024, the government made three decisions whereby it decided to change nothing about what it was exporting to Israel. We literally were exporting tanks at a point where we knew there was widespread evidence that tanks were being used to crush civilians en masse. We were exporting tank parts. On September 2nd, the government came to a new decision. The government represented this decision as a political one. But actually, it's important to note that the following morning, September 3rd at 10 a.m., the government were due in court on this case, and we had threatened to file an interim injunction against them. They imposed a ban on weapons going for use in Gaza. They represented this as 30 of 350 licenses. But actually, this is a massive understatement of what that decision was. Only 90 licenses go to the IDF. The strategic export licensing criteria regulates things like chemical substances and stuff. So actually, it was a very significant decision that stopped all weapons going for use by Israel in Gaza. That is true, except for the F-35s. So the F-35 is a fighter jet, which is described by its manufacturer as the most lethal fighter jet in the world. It can carry 2,000-pound bombs. Israel has specifically modified its fleet to be able to carry more 2,000-pound bombs in any one given flight. 2,000-pound bombs are regularly dropped on schools, refugee camps, hospitals. The UK decided to basically made an assessment of all of the weapons that could be going for use in Gaza, and F-35s were obviously part of those. But for the F-35s, they made an exemption. And that is basically because there are two ways that we used to contribute to the F-35 program, one directly and one indirectly, as Katie mentioned. So essentially, there is a global pooling system whereby different partner countries collaborate on F-35s and pool the planes, but also pool spare parts. F-35s are uniquely reliant on spare parts. And so there's a global pooling system that's organized by the US. And basically what the UK government said was that they couldn't suspend F-35s that go indirectly to Israel through those third countries because it would undermine international peace and security. So currently, there are two ways in which the UK is contributing to Israel's F-35 fleet. The first is every single F-35 in operation globally is at a minimum 15% British made. That's because for some reason, we're the only people who can make ejector seats and things like that. The other way that they contribute is through the spare parts pooling program. And it's important to note that outside of the US, the UK is the number one contributor to Israel's spare parts pooling program. Without those spare parts, they just wouldn't be able to operate in the way that they are operating. So the UK government has argued that essentially international peace and security would so fundamentally be undermined by them changing their adherence to this system that they've made an exception for themselves. We challenge this on five grounds. The first is that this is plainly non-compliant with international law under the Arms Trade Treaty, under the Genocide Convention, under the Geneva Convention. For example, the Common Article 1 of the Geneva Convention requires, and I quote, to respect and ensure respect for the convention in all circumstances. States are under an obligation to ensure respect for international law and the conventions under all circumstances. So that's the first ground that we have. It's non-compliant with international law. It's also non-compliant with domestic law to the extent that these treaties have been incorporated and are applicable in UK law. So it's non-compliant with domestic law. It's unlawful to the extent that it facilitates, there's a risk of facilitating crime. We say that if you're providing these weapons, then there's a serious risk of aiding and abetting war crimes. We say that their assessment of the risk to international peace and security is irrational. It's not going to The world order is not going to disintegrate if they pull out of the F-35 program in the way that they say. And finally, the final ground is basically they've said that there is a good reason to depart from this policy. And that's something that they have to say under domestic law in order to reach that decision. And we say that they've fundamentally failed to calibrate the risk. So they've assessed that there is this risk to international peace and security. But what about the risk of genocide? The risk, you know, the risk that they admit of widespread war crimes and all the rest of it. You also asked why this case is important.
Yeah, would you be able to tell us a little bit about why this is important and also whether it could have an impact on UK sales to other countries as well?
Yeah. So I think there are two main reasons why this case is really important. The first is that F-35s are killing Palestinians daily, and the British government is making us all complicit in genocide. On March 13th, Israel received 3 new F-35s. Now, as I've mentioned, those F-35s will be at a minimum 15% British made. On March 18th, 5 days later, it used those planes to inflict on Palestinians one of the most deadly days of the conflict. Breaking the ceasefire, it killed 436 Palestinians, including 183 children, in one day. And we know that F-35s were used in those strikes. So the first is, these weapons are killing people and it's being done in our name. The second is kind of a wider point, which is basically there is a risk that international law gets eroded to such an extent that it just becomes meaningless. International law depends on domestic jurisdictions to uphold it. It has no enforcement mechanism. The UN doesn't have an enforcement mechanism. Its enforcement mechanism is our courts and us. The UK's own assessment is that Israel is not committed to complying with international law. The UK's own assessment is that there is a risk that F-35s can be used by Israel to breach international humanitarian law. They accept they are having to depart from their own law in order to continue these weapon sales. And they say that they have a good reason to depart because of international peace and security. But we say that's absurd. We say the risk to international peace and security is the complete erosion of international law and the international order that was built to protect all of us in the post-war period. Like, one example of this is Common Article 1 of the Geneva Convention, which says that states have a duty, quote, to ensure respect for the conventions. It has been the UK's long-standing position that extraterritoriality applies, meaning that not only does the UK respect the Geneva Conventions itself, but it encourages and ensures other states respect the Geneva Conventions. The UK has now changed its long-standing position in our case and has said that actually no, ensure respect just means that you ensure respect of your own nationals. That is a really clear example of the complete erosion of international law.
Thank you, Charlotte, for explaining that. So I'm just going to move over to Saeed now to hear a little bit more about Palestine action. So the focus is really on direct action against Israel's arms trade in Britain. Would you be able to just explain a little bit about what Israel's arms trade here looks like?
Thank you for inviting me here, firstly. I think Katie and Charlotte did a very good job of explaining in practical terms what the arms trade and specifically the Israeli arms trade in this country looks like. I think what's also really important to understand, and for me this is a major reason that I became involved in activism, is to understand the continuity of British complicity in Israel's war crimes. So, of course, a lot of the conversation revolves around October 7, but Palestinians have been naming the colonization and ethnic cleansing of Palestine a genocide since long before. So I don't want us to misunderstand that merely because now the conversation about genocide has become a legal one, that this is the start of the genocide. 1948 and the Nakba have been characterized as genocide for decades. You know, Britain, of course, was deeply involved in the creation of the Israeli state. Since the Balfour Declaration of 1917, the British state was arming and training Israeli, Zionist militias. Okay, Zionist militias who were carrying out massacres in between 1917 and 1948. And of course, those militias became absorbed into the IDF, which continues to commit genocide. So Britain's involvement is deeply complicit in every stage of the genocide, in the colonization and ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Now, of course, for commercial reasons in the sale of weapons to Israel and for ideological reasons, which is this desperate need to maintain Israel as an extension of European and in particular British colonialism, British imperialism. That's the reason why this historical link exists between Britain and the Zionist movement initially. Anyway, in very practical terms, aside from the very robust data that's been named here. And of course, with the caveat that a lot of this information is deliberately opaque, so it's impossible to say what the hard facts are. But what we know is that there are eight Elbit sites in particular. Elbit is the Israel's largest private weapons company. They produce 85% of Israel's drone fleet. A lot of those components are produced in this country. And I think what's also important to recognize is, even though Britain will continually, in order to defend itself, the state continually says that, oh, our exports to Israel are in fact not that large, okay? In monetary terms, that may be true. But if you imagine that Britain produces dozens and dozens of components that are central to all of these, every step of the manufacturing process for weapons. So even if we only produce 1% of the F-35 that was central to the production of the F-35, it means that Britain's weapons industry is central, is complicit in the genocide for that reason. So, for example, there is a factory in this country that produces the propulsion system for unmanned armed drones. Even if that component is small in terms of the overall production, it's still fundamental to the use of armed drones. Guidance systems for missiles. It may be a very small component, but it's central to the genocide. So there are eight Elbit factories that are in particular working on research, development, and production of these components. And then there are dozens and dozens of secondary suppliers. So these are businesses that Elbit is reliant on for everything from the insurance to rental of their property to provision of electricity, to things that are more obviously directly involved in the weapons trade, spare parts, metal manufacturing, the insurance for their deliveries, the logistics, et cetera, et cetera. So those constitute what we call the primary targets for Palestine Action, that is Elbit Systems themselves and their subsidiaries, and the secondary targets, which are businesses that Elbit relies on.
Great, thank you. And why do you think like direct action is such an important tactic in this? And also maybe could you give us a couple of examples of some of the successes that Palestine Action has had with this campaign?
Yeah, I mean, direct action historically has been central to nearly every, not only liberation movement, but civil rights and social rights and social justice movement you can imagine. One of the frustrating things about talking about the history of direct action is that it's very often suppressed in the mainstream history of successful movements. So an example I always think of is the resistance against apartheid South Africa. Nelson Mandela's image, of course, has been whitewashed for decades in order to present him merely as a nonviolent activist. And he was indeed someone who embraced peaceful resistance after it was clear to him that the apartheid regime would fall. The reason he was imprisoned in the first place and condemned as a terrorist until very recently by countries like the US and the UK is because he founded and led and fought a campaign of not only civil disobedience, but direct action against the apartheid regime. So sabotaging installations related to the military, related to even the civil management of the apartheid regime. So we, you know, Palestine Action has not invented any of these tactics. Palestine Action has not invented any of the philosophy. But Palestine Action does see itself as an inheritor of a very proud tradition of the use of direct action. Palestine Action, of course, predates October 7, but I do think that post-October 7, we've really, every activist has found themselves in a state of emergency. And in particular, what motivates me is understanding that, well, firstly, my own grandfather was involved in resistance in 1936 against the British occupation of Palestine. So there is a historical link there. But also the fact that the Palestinians in their greatest hour of need have called out to the international community to say, we need you to disrupt the supply chain of weapons directly. Okay? All these forms of resistance, also the legal forms that have been discussed here, are essential. But I would also say that in a state of emergency, there are other steps that are necessary. And as I think is clear from what Katie and Charlotte have described, the political system and the legal system that allows this genocide to continue is deeply corrupt. And perhaps at its core, has no interest in genuinely changing. This is my opinion. I don't mean to speak for you two, sorry. Has no interest in genuinely changing. And so the calculation must be for us to stop the genocide, or at least impact the genocide. We have to materially stop the flow of weapons. We have to materially break the supply chain. So that's where groups like Palestine Action would defend the necessity of direct action at this time.
Great, thank you for explaining that. And just like on the subject, I guess, of legacy of activism, in our Arms Trade magazine, which there's some copies back there, there's a story about the Raytheon 9, which was a case, it's bigger than the Raytheon 9, I guess. There's a long-running case, a campaign in Derry against Raytheon, another US arms company there, and they managed to successfully kick Raytheon out of Derry. And it's a really inspiring story, so yeah. Just check it out. It's in the magazine back there.
You also asked for success yeah. stories of Palestine Action. I'm sorry. Yes, I mean, it is a successful movement in the sense that on a very practical level, two Elbit factories have been shut down because of sustained Palestine Action sabotage. Their central London offices, which were just around the corner from here, also shut down after a sustained campaign in which Palestine Action would lock on in front of the building sometimes two or three times a week. So the tactic is one not only of breaking the supply chain materially, but also simply making the company unsustainable, financially unsustainable. As well as those two factories that have been shut down, Palestine Action has lost Elbit hundreds of millions of pounds worth of both in terms of damage to their factories and the supply chain itself, but also in terms of lost contracts. And in February of this year, they lost their biggest contract yet, which was the Watchkeeper drone. The British government failed to renew their contract for the Watchkeeper drone. And the British government, when they failed to renew contracts, has cited very often the fact that the company is unable to protect its supply chains as a reason. The fact that every time Palestine Action protesters break into a factory, it means it's no longer secure. It means they can no longer simply have standard contract to the MOD that require a very high level of security. So the Watchkeeper drone contract was worth £2.2 billion. That's their biggest loss so far. Then there are a lot of secondary companies that also contributed to the supply chain. Dozens of those every year merely cut ties because in many cases they weren't, the employees weren't aware that they were working for an Israeli weapons supplier. And in the cases where they were, they simply decided it wasn't worth sustained action from Palestine Action. So that part of it, I think, illustrates the strategy of economic isolation.
Great, thank you for that. So the situation in Sudan has been described as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And how complicit is the arms trade in causing that crisis?
Thank you, Amy. And thank you, Palestine House, for this beautifully curated space, Charlotte and Katie, for laying the foundations for this discussion. I am Sudanese. I work with Sudanese civil society who are in the front line responding to the crisis and firefighting, knowing that this is the way that they will stop the war. It takes more than that to stop this war. It takes cut down the supply chain of the arms trade, enforcing the embargo in Sudan, but also holding those who are accountable and facilitating directly or indirectly through the proxy, the supply of weapons into Sudan. Katie, you mentioned the sort of weapons being sold to the to Saudi to the fight in the war of Yemen. And Saudi have contracted the RSF, one of the fighting paramilitary in Sudan, to fight on behalf of them in Yemen for years. So that kind of supply of weapons are going directly to Sudan or indirectly. And the UK government is complicit in terms of protecting civilians, in terms of also leveraging their positions to put pressure into the regional actors in the country, in the region, to whether call for the parties of the warring parties to de-escalate or to, just stop supporting and supplying the weapons into the country that is coming from all directions. It's important to mention that there is a weapons embargo in Darfur since 2005. It's not well enforced and it's also not kind of like implemented into the entire country. There is still weapons coming through Chad, through different bordering countries. So, there is a lot to be done in terms of enforcing these embargoes.
Great, thank you. And there's also I keep plugging the magazine, but there's a bit more background about that in the magazine as well, about the arms embargo and how arms have been getting around that. Maz, would you be able to just say a little bit more about how UK institutions are complicit in this? I'm thinking about some of the targets that they've been in London around, was it one of the football stadiums and that kind of thing? And maybe something about the UAE and how people are kind of campaigning against the UAE here in the UK.
Absolutely. So the British institutions, universities, companies, banks, even recently I learned that the pension funds are investing on arms trades, which is insane to kind of understand. Yeah, so universities are investing, whether it's in research or industries. Recently, University of Bristol allegedly being kind of mentioned in terms of supporting or investing on this. Barclays, there is a massive campaign against Barclays as well, and they're in billions investment on arms trade. The UAE is particularly supporting RSF, the Rapid Response Forces, and that is part of a bigger monopoly around taking Sudan's gold and facilitating that. And they have a particular geopolitical interest in terms of accessing that part of Africa and that positioning themselves within the region. And Sudan is a strategic focus through to them. But not to also forget that there is other countries who are involved, Egypt. Egypt is heavily investing in military and intelligence, in supporting and aiding the conflict in Sudan, and they also have their own interests and geopolitics within the country. But UAE, particularly because of direct connections, and as Charlotte mentioned, there is kind of particular weapons has been kind of found and trace the supply chains and connected directly to UAE. So there is an objective evidence of their involvement within the war in Sudan.
Thank you for explaining that. So one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Katie, was I mentioned earlier about the government saying it's going to increase military spending. How likely is that to benefit arms companies?
Yeah, I mean, I'd nearly flip the question around and be like, arms companies ask for this because they know it is to their own benefit. You know, they have a huge lobby and they have the money to put behind that. I think one thing I do want to say in kind of a positive sense is that while we're seeing things that basically I would describe as reprisals from the arms industry and also from government, that is as a result of effective action that's been taken by ordinary people. So that includes all of the work of Palestine Action. It includes all of the student movement protests. I think it was in the last couple of months that there was cabinet ministers coming out and saying, we cannot have students anymore protesting arms companies. Arms companies provide XYZ. But even to, while they laugh and kind of try to undermine and say all of these movements are pointless, and that's exactly what they said about all of the protests in central London for a year. They kind of mocked them. But then at the same time, actually, when it comes down to it, it's a huge threat to the industry because it actually does work. So there's the global increase in military spending that, of course, arms companies are happy to jump on. And that's not something that is only within the UK. The EU as well, for anyone who's interested in that or is working on that, is something to keep an eye on because of the kind of joint military policy that is new in the last couple of years, and also a joint fund for military action. So many arms companies have relocated to Brussels or made sure they have headquarters there now to lobby the EU. So there's a huge kind of architecture behind all of this. But it's not just about the money. I think that they know that they have never been seen as clearly, I think, by the public as they are now, that there's never been as many people aware of what they're doing and what they've done as there is today. So part of this military expenditure, I think, is, yeah, it's definitely self-interest of these companies. They're private profit-making companies and make huge profits. Their shares, shares have gone up, I think, some of them by double, if not triple, in the last couple of years since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But also it's kind of an opportunity for them to whitewash their image in a new way. And some of the things that have happened over the last couple of months make that so apparent. So I think the kind of military expenditure is one aspect of that. But then, like you mentioned about this kind of, I don't know if other people have heard, in early March, there was a group of 100 MPs that wrote this letter And if you can like see the letter on Twitter, and it's like to Britain's financial institutions and banks, just blanket. It's like one short page kind of saying that they want these financial institutions to make sure that arms companies are labeled as ethical and that they are not, they're never taken out of investment portfolios on the basis of like ESG, environmental, social governance rules. So that would mean that if you went to your pension provider and said, I want to make sure I'm like investing in ESG funds, that arms companies would be in them. There's so many ways how this is corrupt, because like even it's not my the ideology that I subscribe to myself, but like they're kind of claiming, oh, we have this free market where people are actually allowed to invest in what they want to, which includes if you decide on the basis, you know, yourself, based on your ethics. But then when people actually go ahead and do that, they come up with a way to stop, you know. But if it was like a neoliberal kind of saying, and you can invest anywhere you want to, but that's not even true under the system that we have. I think that's like how deeply corrupt and twisted it is. And that letter, like I think I posted it on the Cat Twitter, but I can maybe share with you after. Like the thing that really struck me from it, like I have a little quote from it here. It says that like the key kind of main bit that it said was that the UK arms manufacturers are facing unnecessary barriers to doing business in the UK. The laugh is justified. And then, of course, like, and, you know, Charlotte, I think you'd like would commiserate with this. Like when we were writing to government, like even though we know that they won't reply or they think, you know, like we are so careful. Like we go through every single thing we have is backed up. It's linked. All of our colleagues do exactly the same thing across, you know, like NGOs, activist groups, everyone knows what they're talking about. And this letter that's signed by 100 MPs is like, we're facing unnecessary barriers. They don't say what they are. They don't say, you know, which company has not received finance that was looking for it. It's literally just comms, basically. Like it's just PR. And then the MP that kind of, there's two MPs that are running this, but one of them, Alex Barker, she's the MP for Farnborough, which has a military base on it. So her position as an MP, her being elected, she won't be re-elected if she doesn't support the military, basically. So in that sense, you can kind of see like how even the parliamentary system, yeah, kind of secures these interests. And she is head of an APPG, an all-party parliamentary group. There are these like ad hoc parliamentary groups on different topics that they would have to have like a blend of MPs from different parties, but they're not the same as like select committees that are run by government. They set up a new one after the election for the APPG on defence and security sectors supporting local communities. So, yeah, I know. And I think that actually basically says it all to me, that title in that APPG. Like one thing it says to me is that like all of us have been successful in turning public opinion, not against arms companies for no reason, but based on fact. I think, you know, they've had 10, like say from kind of the work that I'm familiar with CAD and also kind of like CAD's history in recent years and also on Gaza, like these companies have been made aware at every step for literally decades of all of the different crimes that they're complicit in. Like between all the cases that our organizations have worked on, you know, it's like hundreds and hundreds of pages of evidence across both Yemen and Gaza. And BAE Systems was like made something like 33 billion in revenue from the war in Yemen to date from 2015. So that's over those 10 years. They're also the lead partner on the F-35 program. Do they care about their opinion? You know, like if they were so concerned about their public image, they could have stopped any of those exports. So like, while, yeah, this increase in military expenditure is really concerning, I think it's actually a sign of how impactful, how we've been. And I don't want to go on for too much longer, but I did want to say just two other really quick things. One is that they've put aside the government 2 billion of increased capital, like finance for UK export finance loans to overseas buyers. So that'll be taxpayers' money being given to overseas buyers to buy weapons from UK arms manufacturers. So our money is literally going to be used to fund all of that, like that we're paying through our taxes. Yeah. And I think there's more we could say on like that they are purposely pitting again, like welfare expenditure and overseas aid against military expenditure, which is actually like normally we would be making that link. You know, we'd kind of be saying, oh, they're doing this and they're also doing this. But like Keir Starmer presented the increase in defence and then said, I'm cutting welfare, I'm cutting development to do like aid to do it. So I think there's like a lot to untangle there, but yeah, I won't go any longer.
Definitely. Thank you. And one of the, I guess one of the reasons that not just the UK, but also across Europe, that people have been ramping up military spending has been one of the reasons it's cited as the threat of Russia and the invasion of Ukraine. What are your thoughts on that as a kind of reason?
Like, it's interesting. Forgive me for being like really skeptical about all of this, because Russia and NATO are, and what's happened, and like the horrific crimes also that are being committed in Ukraine have been, as Charlotte will know, just used as an excuse to continue the F-35 program again. And there's this really common thread with no detail as to why that's the case. Like, Ukraine doesn't use F-35 jets. So where is the material link there? Even if there was a material link, you have taken, as a government, you have like obligations, you know, for the last like nearly 100 years to international law, to you've claimed for decades that you have a robust, rigorous and robust arms export control system. And now you're just saying, actually, we can't really implement any of it at all. And then when it comes to when military expenditure, it's that same thing of like my colleague Sam actually does a lot of research on this. And one of the things he was saying, that even if you take the US out of the equation, Europe is like, I don't know, 6 times more armed than Russia as a whole. So they'll say we need all this money pumped in to make sure that we can defend ourselves against Russia. But I think we need to be more confident in saying, like, why can't we already defend ourselves against Russia, given all of the investment that's gone into all of these military companies for the last 20 years? Like, what, you know, even kind of from that point of view, they don't say what the investment's actually going into or how. It's just a kind of, we need to do this increase in expenditure. And yeah, it's actually like, I think there's maybe more, I'll leave it there. Maybe some other people will come in.
If I could just add on to that. Yeah, totally. They have literally pleaded in our case that if they remove themselves from the F-35 global program, it will lead to a long and protracted ground war with Russia. By what mechanism? I mean, yeah, so totally. Yeah. Just the completely opaque and unsubstantiated way in which this like obscure threat from Russia is put. And also, just to say, what we actually should be saying is like the inverse of that. Like, the UK had a wonderful response when the full-scale invasion, when Russia full-scale invaded Ukraine. Why can that not be mirrored in Palestine? It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, can I come in really quickly on one other bit I just thought of on this? It's just very interesting that, say, that position that was kind of the Labour government came up with in July, which they basically, some other colleagues have said, like the Tories had a similar response prepared for eventually when they would have to do some kind of halt on licensing, was made in like the Biden presidency. And now, even though Russia was supposed to be our biggest enemies, you have the US, who our government are always trying to appease. Like, Trump seems to be best friends with Putin, and like the kind of the like disgraceful stuff that's been happening on different global stages on that, you know, like taking Ukrainian resources, like basically profiting off the back of the Ukrainian invasion. It actually, you know, the kind of the incoherence is becoming ever more apparent there. So like, it looks like US and Russia really are like as a duo would be the threat, not the other way around. Yeah. So
yeah, thank you. So yeah, one of the things that we kind of talk about a lot is that how the arms trade is a global thing. And Saeed, you mentioned Elbit earlier, which is an Israeli arms company, which has many premises here, but also in other countries around the world. In the magazine, there's an article about the relationship between the Indian government and the Israeli government, and how that is also related to Elbit and Elbit's operations in India, and how also people are trying to campaign against Elbit there as well. And I know in many other countries as well. So I was wondering, Saeed, does Palestine Action have contact with activists taking action against Israel's arms trade outside the UK? And what do you think we can learn from each other in different places?
Yes. So they're often kind of, I mean, it's hard to describe because I don't want to make it sound as though Palestine Action is some kind of bureaucracy. So I don't want to call it like a branch or, you know, but there are, it's a network. So there are some groups that are explicitly called Palestine Action, France, Palestine Action, Italy. And the fundamental, the core philosophy and the core tactic and strategies are aligned. They're all based around direct action and materially breaking the supply chain. But also what's crucial is that each of them has to deal with the reality in their own countries. Each of them has to deal with also in exactly what form Israel's weapons manufacturing takes in their countries. And they also have to deal explicitly with the threat. So Palestine Action in the US has to operate in a very different way, because there is very plausible possibility of being killed by the police in the US. On that high level, that sort of risk doesn't exist in the UK, not as immediately. But the tactics need to be different, and they need to take that into account. But we're constantly learning from also groups that are aligned with Palestine Action that may not be called Palestine Action. So there was a recent action in Denmark against the headquarters of Maersk, the shipping company, because they hold the license for Israeli weapons shipments, typically going from the US through Europe to Israel. They blockaded, using very similar tactics of direct action, blockaded the main port there to try and ensure that a ship carrying Israeli parts couldn't leave. They're not exactly a Palestine Action branch, but they're very, very much aligned in terms of strategy and tactics. And the other thing is Palestine Action, although we don't necessarily have work as in-depth as these two groups, but what Palestine Action does have access to is, for example, when there's an action that breaks into a factory, they find there very often paperwork that traces the supply chain. Very often that paperwork contradicts the legal licenses that these companies hold. They also find, for example, packaging from other companies, which means suddenly we understand more about where these supplies are coming from, and packing lists that explain. And in many of these cases, again, they break either British licensing law or even international law. When you talk about, for example, the links with India and Kashmir, we have to understand that the Israeli state and by extension the Israeli weapons industry has been deeply involved in more or less every heinous, disgusting dictatorship in history that you can imagine, largely since 1967 when Elbit was founded, but even prior. So what we find is also the evidence of Israeli weapons being traded with countries that are actually under embargo. So all of that becomes a sort of pool of intelligence that those groups then use to change their tactics depending also on where is the most effective target. Because, Palestine Action wants to succeed, and Palestine Action wants to succeed despite politicians, right? It's not a group that's appealing to the political process. So Palestine Action needs to find the most vulnerable spot in a supply chain and break that. So the intelligence gathering and the intelligence sharing with other countries is crucial in devising those tactics.
Great, thank you. And Maz, what connections have you been seeing kind of being made across borders when it comes to what's happening in Sudan?
I think there is a lot of connections across borders. Sudanese campaigners are connecting to Palestinians, to those in Congo, in Yemen, sharing strategies with the understanding that the companies, the governments who are profiting from this war are all connected, and these weapons don't just land. They are sold, they are licensed, they are transferred directly or indirectly through proxies, through allies in these countries. There is also a new emerging kind of a state involving in the war in Sudan at the moment, Iran through the drones. So that's in the last few months, I completely shifted how particular military groups kind of had a control. I wouldn't call it sort of advanced or anything because of how civilians are caught in the middle. But basically, they came with a new sort of weapons and drones that shifted completely the tactics and who won the war in the ground. So yeah, sharing these strategies and connecting. Part of my work also involves supporting and working with grassroots organizations who are also rooted in movement and social change. And they operate under extremely restricted civic spaces. Speaking about them, exposing them, obviously, it's something that, will kind of risk the work that they're doing. But I can speak about Madaniya, which is a London-based sort of diaspora born out of a need to highlight the atrocities and the dire situations in Sudan. But also, they're quite bold and radical and trying East and West to grab the attention of politicians. You can see them in Westminster just chasing MPs, but also organizing protests and, doing this kind of work and connecting with others who are, yeah, who are also struggling. And I mentioned Congo and Yemen. So yeah, I think movements are connected. Strategies are shared. And as solidarity.
Great, thank you. Saeed, you mentioned something about like in spite of government or like, I can't remember what exact phrase you used, but I wanted to ask you a little bit about the clampdown on arms trade activists in the UK recently. And obviously there was a big case in Bristol, but I know that lots of other Palestine Action activists have been targeted as well. And I guess while this is part of like a wider clampdown on protests, what are some of the ways Palestine Action has experienced this?
Yeah, it's quite incredible to think when Palestine Action started in 2021, you know, there was maybe 6 months where you could run into the Elbit headquarters here on Kingsway, spray red paint, throw files around the building, and the police just let them get away with it. And this happened several times, partly because the laws didn't yet exist, but partly because the police were just taken by surprise and didn't really understand this fairly new tactic, at least being applied to the Israeli weapons companies. The political climate and the policing climate is just unrecognizable now to what it was even 4 years ago when Palestine Action started. In a way, I mean, of course, the irony is that I'm sure the state thinks the clampdown is going to terrify protesters. But, you know, Palestine Action and the level, the number of new activists joining Palestine Action has never been higher. So what's clear is that they understand these measures are being taken not only to suppress solidarity with Palestinians, but also this is a general attack on democracy, on the right to protest, on freedom of speech in the UK. So although now the political resistance to that is coming from groups, you know, specifically around Palestine, it should be something that terrifies everyone. You know, you mentioned I'm a filmmaker, and I've never seen this kind of environment in which shows, theater plays are being canceled for mentioning the word Gaza. Journalists are being arrested for reporting on Gaza. Funding is being pulled for people for pro-Palestinian artists. Venues are refusing to show work about Palestine. You know, this is a really fascistic level of censorship. So the work Palestine Action is doing now is still firmly dedicated towards liberation of Palestine and ending this phase of the genocide. But I also see it as a movement that's just defending the fundamentals of democracy. So probably the most terrifying mechanism that the state has used now, although I think it has been misunderstood in mainstream media, but you refer to the Filton 18, who were a group of activists who attacked who sabotaged, I would say, Elbit's what Elbit claims is a research and development facility in Filton. It's in fact also a warehouse. They found quadcopters in there. Okay, and you know, these are, for those who don't know, these are the quadcopters that fly over a site after it's been bombed by the 2,000-pound bombs that Charlotte mentioned and picks off and kills any survivors. They're also the quadcopters you may have heard that play the sound. Sorry, I can barely describe this without breaking into tears. That play the sound of children crying in order to draw other survivors out and then pick them off one by one. So those weapons were discovered in the factory, and you know, I can think of no more justified and righteous action than destroying those by hand, as the brave activists did in Filton. They were arrested under the Terrorism Act. I think it's very often misrepresented in the media that they are on trial for terrorism charges. That's untrue. It would be impossible. You know, Elbit has tried lobbying the British government. Various politicians have tried lobbying the British government. Obviously, Israel's embassy has tried lobbying the British government to convince them to reclassify Palestine Action as a terrorist organization. And even under the UK's fairly lax definition of terrorism, they failed twice. So it was never going to happen. And those activists will, at least for now, never be tried for terrorism. But they were arrested under the Terrorism Act, which gives the state much broader powers to hold them for longer and to search their homes, to search their families' homes. So it was clearly done to terrify other activists, which, as I mentioned, has failed miserably. But what they are being tried under is what's called terrorism related, meaning that if they're found guilty, the judge can then consider, without the jury, by the way, can consider the terrorism related link, which requires zero evidence in their sentencing. So in other words, he or she could extend the sentence because it has this quote terrorism link. So, in legal terms, it's extremely flimsy. It could, of course, have material effect on the length of their prison sentence if they're found guilty. They will have spent about a year in prison before even being tried. So it's also important to understand that the use of remand is being done as a sort of the process is the punishment. So even if they're found not guilty, they will have spent about a year in prison on remand. So again, a misuse of the Terrorism Act to say that because they're such quote-unquote high-level prisoners, they should not be on remand because they still pose a risk to the public.
Thank you for that. So I'm just going to ask each of you, just before we finish, and then we'll move to questions, what's one key thing that people could do after this event to kind of support what you're doing? I'll start with you, Maz.
Yes, really good question. I would start with public pressure. It works. Speak to your MP, highlight these concerns and speak on behalf of those who do not have access to these decision-making spaces of power. Those who are under, conflict or restricted civic spaces or cannot campaign publicly. That is really important. Holding institutions accountable who are indirectly or directly involved in the arms trade in the UK. One of the actions in a different levels. I think what Katie and Charlotte are doing, which is challenging them legal, kind of that's important, not just for Sudan, not for Palestine, but also for the UK, for the sake of democracy. I think that is important, and upholding international law and canvassing and putting all the pressures that needed, diplomatic, legal, and public to rectify this.
I just wanted to also just give a quick mention to London for Sudan, who put us in touch with Maz, who's a group working here in London on Sudan and also working in collaboration with other groups as well. Charlotte.
Thanks. Mine is just embarrassingly basic, but Saeed mentioned the completely dire funding situation for Palestine-related advocacy. And GLAN has taken a huge financial risk in taking this case, and we rely completely on crowdfunding. Litigation is very, very, very expensive to bring. That's why we are the only Palestine-related case that has reached the courts. So please, please donate to us if you're in a position. We have a GLAN crowdfunder, and we rely on that to do this kind of work. And just more generally, I think everything that we've heard here, the arms export, the UK arms export licensing regime is not fit for purpose when 15,000 children have been killed in Gaza alone, and we're still exporting £2,000 bombs. It just doesn't work. And so I think, and also as Katie has really well outlined, it's just getting bigger. It's just snowballing. So yeah, all the actions that Maz said, email your MP, make this your thing. Like, let's get even louder about this.
Yeah, either of you can go next.
Yeah, so kind of immediate things. We have like a petition on our website at the moment, which is, you might be aware of the DSEI Arms Fair in September. So it's every 2 years in London. It's like one of the world's biggest arms fair. It could be either the biggest or the second biggest. And every year there's an Israeli military delegation that are sent, and they have like a pavilion with their weapons for sale. So it's to not issue the visas for any of these. And there's like legislation that backs that up from the lovely Home Office, that they should not be issuing visas to war criminals. So please add your name to that. And in the next week, we'll have like another email your MP action specifically on the case and on the F-35s. But kind of more generally as well, I think this anyway, but this conversation is also reminding me that this system is so oppressive, even though maybe potentially in London we could be in like a position of privilege, but yet we also have to be oppressed by this system to be, against our will, complicit in it. So I think like have a think yourself about, is there anywhere in my life, whether it's like my job, my pension, it's whether it's people I know, where I could like interject or where I could say something or like where I could write and to somebody. And I think especially where you might think, actually, maybe no one else in this space has raised this, those places are like particularly effective. I will say that is the most like will be the most awkward and the most you'll feel the most push or pull back. But that means that's probably a good place to bring it up. And yeah, and not to get. Yeah, I know how like how horrific all of this is, but like all of the things that we've mentioned of the pushback is because of everything that people are doing is actually working. So it's just not to listen to the messaging from government that we have so much power.
Yeah, that's great advice. I think honestly everything I do in my life now, whether it's a panel like this or a film event or Q&A after a screening, is just to inspire people to go out and chain themselves to the gates of an Israeli weapons factory. If you can't do that, you can, of course, donate to Palestine Action. If you can't do that, you can volunteer just to wait outside a police station for actionists to come out. There's nothing that I think keeps the fire alive in someone's soul more than it's 3 a.m, you're exhausted, you're probably wearing a prison sweatsuit, and you're released somewhere maybe you don't recognize, and there's a group of people waving Palestinian flags and cheering for you, and giving you a hug and giving you a mug of hot tea or taking you out for a drink. If you can't do that, you can follow where an action is happening and simply show up and show your support. You know, there have been some incredible, displays of civic support, of community support at one factory in Leicester that was sort of under occupation by Palestine Action activists. The whole community came out because they were horrified to know that there was a factory in their backyard. Ordinary people who've never challenged the state in their lives drove their cars in front of the gates to stop the police vans from entering. The police called the fire brigade to bring the activists down from the roof, and the fire brigade refused. I mean, it's one of the most beautiful examples of civil disobedience and mass resistance I've ever seen in this country. When I was locked with my friends outside Elbit's headquarters here on Kingsway, my spirits were so lifted by people who just waved and said hello and that they supported us. So that's my advice, is to find a way to avoid your soul being crushed in what is a very soul-crushing time, but to find a way to refuse to be frightened into inaction.
Great, thank you. Thanks to all of you.
That was my colleague and New Internationalist co-editor Amy Hall at the launch of our new series, How to Stop the Arms Trade, hosted at Palestine House in London on April 28th. You also heard from Saeed Taji Farouki from Direct Action Group Palestine Action, Maz Saleh Idres, a Sudanese peace builder and international programs manager at Peace Direct, Katie Fallon, the advocacy manager for Campaign Against the Arms Trade, and Charlotte Andrews-Briscoe, a lawyer for Global Legal Action Network, which is taking on the UK government in the courts over its arms exports to Israel. For more on our new series on how to stop the arms trade, check out the link in our show notes. We have lots of coverage coming out across our newsletters and print magazine over the next year that you won't want to miss. New subscribers to New Internationalist can also get 20% off their first year of a print and or digital subscription using the discount code THEWORLDUNSPUN at checkout. This podcast was produced by me, Maxine Betteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, Amy Hall, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuz. Audio editing is by Nasik Hamza. Thanks for listening. We'll be back soon.